standing up now. The cross with the circumpunct in the middle is a binary symbol. Two symbols fused to create one. What are you saying?
Catherine's eyes followed him as he paced the room.
The cross, Langdon said, was not a Christian symbol until the 4th century. Long before that, it was used by the Egyptians to represent the intersection of two dimensions, the human and the celestial. As above, so below. It was a visual representation of the juncture where man and God become one.
Okay.
The circumpunct, Langdon said, we already know has many meanings. One of its most esoteric being the rose, the alchemical symbol for perfection. But when you place a rose on the center of a cross, you create another symbol entirely, the rose cross. Galloway reclined in his chair, smiling.
My, my, now you're cooking.
Catherine stood now, too.
What am I missing?
The rose cross, Langdon explained, is a common symbol in Freemasonry. In fact, one of the degrees of the Scottish Rite is called Knights of the Rose Cross, and honors the early Rosicrucians, who contributed to Masonic mystical philosophy. Peter may have mentioned the Rosicrucians to you. Dozens of great scientists were members. John Dee, Elias Ashmole, Robert Fludd.
Absolutely, Catherine said. I've read all of the Rosicrucian manifestos in my research.
Every scientist should, Langdon thought. The Order of the Rose Cross, or more formally, the ancient and mystical order Rose Crucis, had an enigmatic history that had greatly influenced science and closely paralleled the legend of the ancient mysteries. Early sages possessing secret wisdom that was passed down through the ages and studied by only the brightest minds. Admittedly, history's list of famous Rosicrucians was a who's who of European Renaissance luminaries. Paracelsus, Bacon, Fludd, Descartes, Pascal, Spinoza, Newton, Leibniz. According to Rosicrucian doctrine, the order was built on esoteric truths of the ancient past truths, which had to be concealed from the average man, and which promised great insight into the spiritual realm. The Brotherhood's symbol had blossomed over the years into a flowering rose on an ornate cross, but it had begun as a more modest dotted circle on an unadorned cross. The simplest manifestation of the rose on the simplest manifestation of the cross.
Peter and I often discuss Rosicrucian philosophy, Galloway told Catherine.
As the dean began outlining the interrelationship between Masonry and Rosicrucianism, Langdon felt his attention drawn back to the same nagging thought he'd had all night. Jehovah Sanctus Unus. This phrase is linked to alchemy somehow. He still could not remember exactly what Peter had told him about the phrase, but for some reason the mention of Rosicrucianism seemed to have rekindled the thought.
Think, Robert.
The Rosicrucian founder, Galloway was saying, was allegedly a German mystic who went by the name Christian Rosenkreutz, a pseudonym, obviously, perhaps even for Francis Bacon, who some historians believe founded the group himself, although there is no proof of
a pseudonym,
Langdon declared suddenly, startling even himself.
That's it. Jehovah Sanctus Unus. It's a pseudonym.
What are you talking about? Catherine demanded.
Langdon's pulse had quickened now. All night I've been trying to remember what Peter told me about Jehovah Sanctus Unus and its relationship to alchemy. Finally I remembered, it's not about alchemy so much as about an alchemist, a very famous alchemist. Galloway chuckled.
It's about time, Professor. I mentioned his name twice and also the word pseudonym.
Langdon stared at the old dean.
You knew?
Well, I had my suspicions when you told me the engraving said Jehovah Sanctus Unus, and had been decrypted using Dürer's alchemical magic square, but when you found the rose cross I was certain. As you probably know, the personal papers of the scientist in question included a very heavily annotated copy of the Rosicrucian manifestos.
Who? Catherine asked.
One of the world's greatest scientists, Langdon replied. He was an alchemist, a member of the Royal Society of London, a Rosicrucian, and he signed some of his most secretive science papers with a pseudonym, Jehovah Sanctus Unus.
One true God? Catherine said. Modest guy.
Brilliant guy, actually, Galloway corrected. He signed his name that way because, like the ancient adepts, he understood himself as divine. In addition, because the 16 letters in Jehovah Sanctus Unus could be rearranged to spell his name in Latin, making it a perfect pseudonym.
Catherine now looked puzzled. Jehovah Sanctus Unus is an anagram of a famous alchemist's name in Latin?
Langdon grabbed a piece of paper and pencil off the dean's desk, writing as he talked.
Latin interchanges the letters J for I and the letter V for you, which means Jehovah Sanctus Unus can actually be perfectly rearranged to spell this man's name.
Langdon wrote down 16 letters. Isaacus Newtonius. He handed the slip of paper to Catherine and said, I think you've heard of him.
Isaac Newton? Catherine demanded, looking at the paper. That's what the engraving on the pyramid was trying to tell us?
For a moment, Langdon was back in Westminster Abbey, standing at Newton's pyramidical tomb, where he had experienced a similar epiphany. And tonight, the great scientist surfaces again. It was no coincidence, of course. The pyramids, mysteries, science, hidden knowledge, it was all intertwined. Newton's name had always been a recurring guidepost for those seeking secret knowledge.
Isaac Newton, Galloway said, must have something to do with how to decipher the meaning of the pyramid.
I can't imagine what it would be, but...
Genius! Catherine exclaimed, her eyes going wide. That's how we transform the pyramid.
You understand? Langdon said.
Yes, she said. I can't believe we didn't see it. It has been staring us right in the face. A simple alchemical process. I can transform this pyramid using basic science, Newtonian science.
Langdon strained to understand.
Dean Galloway, Catherine said. If you read the ring, it says, stop.
The old dean suddenly raised his finger in the air and motioned for silence. Gently, he cocked his head to the side, as if he were listening to something. After a moment, he stood abruptly.
My friends, this pyramid obviously has secrets left to reveal. I don't know what Ms. Solomon is getting at, but if she knows your next step, then I have played my role. Pack up your things and say no more to me. Leave me in darkness for the moment. I would prefer to have no information to share, should our visitors try to force me.
Visitors? Catherine said, listening. I don't hear anyone.
You will, Galloway said, heading for the door. Hurry.
Across town, a cell tower was attempting to contact a phone that lay in pieces on Massachusetts Avenue. Finding no signal, it redirected the call to voicemail.
Robert, Warren Bellamy's panicked voice shouted. Where are you? Call me. Something terrible is happening.
Chapter 86. In the cerulean glow of his basement lights, Malach stood at the stone table and continued his preparations. As he worked, his empty stomach growled. He paid no heed. His days of servitude to the whims of his flesh were behind him. Transformation requires sacrifice. Like many of history's most spiritually evolved men, Malach had committed to his path by making the noblest of flesh sacrifices. Castration had been less painful than he had imagined, and, he had learned, far more common. Every year, thousands of men underwent surgical gelding, orchiectomy, as the process was known. Their motivations ranging from transgender issues to curbing sexual addictions to deep-seated spiritual beliefs. For Malach, the reasons were of the highest nature, like the mythological self-castrated Attis. Malach knew that achieving immortality required a clean break with the material world of male and female. The androgyne is one. Nowadays, eunuchs were shunned, although the ancients understood the inherent power of this transmutational sacrifice. Even the early Christians had heard Jesus himself extol its virtues in Matthew 19:12. There are those who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. He who is able to accept this, let him accept it. Peter Solomon had made a flesh sacrifice, although a single hand was a small price in the grand scheme. By night's end, however, Solomon would be sacrificing much, much more. In order to create,
I must destroy. Such was the nature of polarity. Peter Solomon, of course, deserved the fate that awaited him tonight. It would be a fitting end. Long ago he had played the pivotal role in Moloch's mortal life path. For this reason, Peter had been chosen to play the pivotal role in Moloch's great transformation. This man had earned all the horror and pain he was about to endure. Peter Solomon was not the man the world believed he was. He sacrificed his own son. Peter Solomon had once presented his son, Zachary, with an impossible choice: wealth or wisdom. Zachary chose poorly. The boy's decision had begun a chain of events that eventually dragged the young man into the depths of hell. Soganlık prison. Zachary Solomon had died in that Turkish prison. The whole world knew the story. But what they didn't know was that Peter Solomon could have saved his son. I was there, Moloch thought. I heard it all. Moloch had never forgotten that night. Solomon's brutal decision had meant the end of his son Zach, but it had been the birth of Moloch. Some must die that others may live. As the light over Moloch's head began changing color again, he realized the hour was late. He completed his preparations and headed back up the ramp. It was time to attend to matters of the mortal world. Chapter 87. All is revealed at the 33rd degree, Catherine thought as she ran. I know how to transform the pyramid. The answer had been right in front of them all night. Catherine and Langdon were alone now, dashing through the cathedral's annex, following signs for the Garth. Now, exactly as the dean had promised, they burst out of the cathedral into a massive walled-in courtyard. The cathedral garth was a cloistered pentagonal garden with a bronze postmodern fountain. Catherine was amazed how loudly the fountain's flowing water seemed to be reverberating in the courtyard. Then she realized it was not the fountain she was hearing. "Helicopter!" she shouted, as a beam of light pierced the night sky above them. "Get under that portico!" The dazzling glare of a searchlight flooded the garth just as Langdon and Catherine reached the other side, slipping beneath a gothic arch into a tunnel that led to the outside lawn. They waited, huddled in the tunnel, as the helicopter passed overhead and began circling the cathedral in wide arcs. "I guess Galloway was right about hearing visitors," Catherine said, impressed. "Bad eyes make for great ears." Her own ears now pounded rhythmically with her racing pulse. "This way," Langdon said, clutching his daybag and moving through the passage. Dean Galloway had given them a single key and a clear set of directions. Unfortunately, when they reached the end of the short tunnel, they found themselves separated from their destination by a wide open expanse of lawn, currently flooded with light from the helicopter overhead.
"We can't get across," Catherine said.
"Hold on. Look." Langdon pointed to a black shadow that was materializing on the lawn to their left. The shadow began as an amorphous blob, but it was growing quickly, moving in their direction, becoming more defined, rushing at them faster and faster, stretching and finally transforming itself into a massive black rectangle crowned by two impossibly tall spires.
"The cathedral facade is blocking the searchlight," Langdon said. "They're landing out in front."
Langdon grabbed Catherine's hand.
"Run, now!"
Inside the cathedral, Dean Galloway felt a lightness in his step that he had not felt in years. He moved through the great crossing, down the nave toward the narthex and the front doors. He could hear the helicopter hovering in front of the cathedral now, and he imagined its lights coming through the rose window in front of him, throwing spectacular colors all over the sanctuary. He recalled the days when he could see color. Ironically, the lightless void that had become his world had illuminated many things for him.
"I see more clearly now than ever."
Galloway had been called to God as a young man, and over his lifetime had loved the church as much as any man could. Like many of his colleagues who had given their lives in earnest to God, Galloway was weary. He had spent his life straining to be heard above the din of ignorance.
"What did I expect?"
From the Crusades to the Inquisition to American politics, the name Jesus had been hijacked as an ally in all kinds of power struggles. Since the beginning of time, the ignorant had always screamed the loudest
herding the unsuspecting masses and forcing them to do their bidding. They defended their worldly desires by citing scripture they did not understand. They celebrated their intolerance as proof of their convictions. Now, after all these years, mankind had finally managed to utterly erode everything that had once been so beautiful about Jesus.
Tonight, encountering the symbol of the Rose Cross had fueled him with great hope, reminding him of the prophecies written in the Rosicrucian manifestos, which Galloway had read countless times in the past and could still recall.
Chapter 1. Jehovah will redeem humanity by revealing those secrets which he previously reserved only for the elect.
Chapter 4.
The whole world shall become as one book, and all the contradictions of science and theology shall be reconciled. Chapter 7. Before the end of the world, God shall create a great flood of spiritual light to alleviate the suffering of humankind.
Chapter 8.
Before this revelation is possible, the world must sleep away the intoxication of her poisoned chalice, which was filled with the false life of the theological vine. Galloway knew the church had long ago lost her way, and he had dedicated his life to righting her course. Now he realized the moment was fast approaching. It is always darkest before the dawn. CIA field agent Turner Simpkins was perched on the strut of the Sikorsky helicopter as it touched down on the frosty grass. He leaped off, joined by his men, and immediately waved the chopper back up into the air to keep an eye on all the exits. Nobody leaves this building. As the chopper rose back into the night sky, Simpkins and his team ran up the stairs to the cathedral's main entrance. Before he could decide which of the six doors to pound on, one of them swung open.
"Yes?" a calm voice said from the shadows.
Simpkins could barely make out the hunched figure in priest's robes.
"Are you Dean Colin Galloway?"
"I am,"
the old man replied.
"I'm looking for Robert Langdon. Have you seen him?"
The old man stepped forward now, staring past Simpkins with eerie blank eyes.
"Now, wouldn't that be a miracle?"
Chapter 88.
Time is running out. Security analyst Nola Kay was already on edge, and the third mug of coffee she was now drinking had begun coursing through her like an electric current.
No word yet from Sato.
Finally her phone rang and Nola leaped on it.
OS, she answered. Nola here.
Nola, it's Rick Parrish in Systems Security.
Nola slumped. No Sato.
Hi, Rick. What can I do for you?
I wanted to give you a heads up. Our department may have information relevant to what you're working on tonight.
Nola set down her coffee. How the hell do you know what I'm working on tonight?
I beg your pardon?
Sorry, it's the new CI program we're beta testing, Parrish said. It keeps flagging your workstation number.
Nola now realized what he was talking about. The agency was currently running a new piece of collaborative integration software designed to provide real-time alerts to disparate CIA departments when they happened to be processing related data fields. In an era of time-sensitive terrorist threats, the key to thwarting disaster was often as simple as a heads-up telling you that the guy down the hall was analyzing the very data you needed. As far as Nola was concerned, this CI software had proven more of a distraction than any real help. Constant interruption software, she called it.
Right, I forgot, Nola said. What have you got?
She was positive that nobody else in the building knew about this crisis, much less could be working on it. The only computer work Nola had done tonight was historical research for Sato on esoteric Masonic topics. Nonetheless, she was obliged to play the game.
Well, it's probably nothing, Parrish said, but we stopped a hacker tonight, and the CI program keeps suggesting I share the information with you.
A hacker? Nola sipped her coffee.
I'm listening.
About an hour ago, Parrish said,
we snagged a guy named Zubianis, trying to access a file on one of our internal databases.
This guy claims it was a job for hire and that he has no idea why he was being paid to access this particular file, or even that it was on a CIA server.
Okay.
We finished questioning him, and he's clean. But here's the weird thing. The same file he was targeting had been flagged earlier tonight by an internal search engine. It looks like someone piggybacked into our system, ran a specific keyword search,
and generated a redaction. The thing is, the keywords they used are really strange. And there's one in particular that the CI flagged as a high-priority match, one that's unique to both of our data sets. He paused. Do you know the word Symbolon? Nola jolted upright, spilling coffee on her desk. The other keywords are just as unusual, Parrish continued. Pyramid, portal. Get down here, Nola commanded, mopping up her desk, and bring everything you've got. These words actually mean something to you? Now!
Chapter 89 Cathedral College is an elegant, castle-like edifice, located adjacent to the National Cathedral. The College of Preachers, as it was originally envisioned by the first Episcopal Bishop of Washington, was founded to provide ongoing education for clergy after their ordination. Today, the college offers a wide variety of programs on theology, global justice, healing, and spirituality. Langdon and Catherine had made the dash across the lawn and used Galloway's key to slip inside just as the helicopter rose back over the cathedral, its floodlights turning night back into day. Now, standing breathless inside the foyer, they surveyed their surroundings. The windows provided sufficient illumination, and Langdon saw no reason to turn the lights on and take a chance of broadcasting their whereabouts to the helicopter overhead. As they moved down the central hallway, they passed a series of conference halls, classrooms, and sitting areas. The interior reminded Langdon of the neo-Gothic buildings of Yale University, breathtaking on the outside and yet surprisingly utilitarian on the inside, their period elegance having been retrofitted to endure heavy foot traffic.
Down here, Catherine said, motioning toward the far end of the hall.
Catherine had yet to share with Langdon her new revelation regarding the pyramid, but apparently the reference to Isaacus Newtonius had sparked it. All she had said as they crossed the lawn was that the pyramid could be transformed using simple science. Everything she needed, she believed, could probably be found in this building. Langdon had no idea what she needed or how Catherine intended to transform a solid piece of granite or gold, but considering he had just witnessed a cube metamorphose into a Rosicrucian cross, he was willing to have faith. They reached the end of the hall and Catherine frowned, apparently not seeing what she wanted.
You said this building has dormitory facilities?
Yes, for residential conferences.
So they must have a kitchen in here somewhere, right?
You're hungry? She frowned back at him.
No, I need a lab.
Of course you do. Langdon spotted a descending staircase that bore a promising symbol. America's favorite pictogram. An image of a knife and fork. The basement kitchen was industrial-looking, lots of stainless steel and big bowls, clearly designed to cook for large groups. The kitchen had no windows. Catherine closed the door and flipped on the lights. The exhaust fans came on automatically. She began rooting around in the cupboards for whatever it was she needed.
Robert, she directed, put the pyramid out on the island, if you would.
Feeling like the novice sous chef taking orders from Daniel Boulou, Langdon did as he was told, removing the pyramid from his bag and placing the gold capstone on top of it. When he finished, Catherine was busy filling an enormous pot with hot tap water.
Would you please lift this to the stove for me?
Langdon heaved the sloshing pot onto the stove as Catherine turned on the gas burner and cranked up the flame. Are we doing lobsters? He asked, hopefully.
Very funny. No, we're doing alchemy, and for the record, this is a pasta pot, not a lobster pot.
She pointed to the perforated strainer insert that she had removed from the pot and placed on the island beside the pyramid. Silly me. And boiling pasta is going to help us decipher the pyramid?
Catherine ignored the comment, her tone turning serious. As I'm sure you know, there is a historical and symbolic reason the Masons chose 33 as their highest degree.
Of course, Langdon said. In the days of Pythagoras, 6 centuries before Christ, the tradition of numerology hailed the number 33 as the highest of all the master numbers. It was the most sacred figure, symbolizing divine truth. The tradition lived on within the Masons and elsewhere. It was no coincidence that Christians were taught that Jesus was crucified at age 33, despite no real historical evidence to that effect. Nor was it a coincidence that Joseph was said to have been 33 when he married the Virgin Mary,
or that Jesus accomplished 33 miracles, or that God's name was mentioned 33 times in Genesis, or that in Islam all the dwellers of heaven were permanently 33 years old.
33, Catherine said, is a sacred number in many mystical traditions.
Correct. Langdon still had no idea what this had to do with a pasta pot.
So it should come as no surprise to you that an early alchemist, Rosicrucian, and mystic like Isaac Newton also considered the number 33 special.
I'm sure he did, Langdon replied. Newton was deep into numerology, prophecy, and astrology. But what does
all is revealed at the 33rd degree?
Langdon pulled Peter's ring from his pocket and read the inscription. Then he glanced back at the pot of water. Sorry, you lost me.
Robert, earlier tonight, we all assumed 33rd degree referred to the Masonic degree. And yet, when we rotated that ring 33 degrees, the cube transformed and revealed a cross. At that moment, we realized the word degree was being used in another sense.
Yes, degrees of arc.
Exactly. But degree has a third meaning as well.
Langdon eyed the pot of water on the stove. Temperature.
Exactly, she said. It was right in front of us all night. All is revealed at the 33rd degree. If we bring this pyramid's temperature to 33 degrees, it may just reveal something.
Langdon knew Catherine Solomon was exceptionally bright, and yet she seemed to be missing a rather obvious point. If I'm not mistaken, 33 degrees is almost freezing. Shouldn't we be putting the pyramid in the freezer? Catherine smiled.
Not if we want to follow the recipe written by the great alchemist and Rosicrucian mystic who signed his papers Jehova Sanctus Unus.
Isaacus Newtonius wrote recipes?
Robert, temperature is the fundamental alchemical catalyst, and it was not always measured in Fahrenheit and Celsius. There are far older temperature scales. One of them invented by Isaac...
The Newton scale, Langdon said, realizing she was right.
Yes. Isaac Newton invented an entire system of quantifying temperature based entirely on natural phenomena. The temperature of melting ice was Newton's base point, and he called it the zeroth degree.
She paused.
I suppose you can guess what degree he assigned the temperature of boiling water, the king of all alchemical processes?
33.
Yes, 33. The 33rd degree. On the Newton scale, the temperature of boiling water is 33 degrees. I remember asking my brother once why Newton chose that number. I mean, it seemed so random. Boiling water is the most fundamental alchemical process, and he chose 33? Why not 100? Why not something more elegant? Peter explained that to a mystic like Isaac Newton, there was no number more elegant than 33.
All is revealed at the 33rd degree. Langdon glanced at the pot of water, and then over at the pyramid. Catherine, the pyramid is made out of solid granite and solid gold. Do you really think boiling water is hot enough to transform it? The smile on her face told Langdon that Catherine knew something he did not know. Confidently, she walked over to the island, lifted the gold-capped granite pyramid, and set it in the strainer. Then she carefully lowered it into the bubbling water.
Let's find out, shall we?
High above the National Cathedral, the CIA pilot locked the helicopter in auto-hover mode and surveyed the perimeter of the building and the grounds. No movement. His thermal imaging couldn't penetrate the cathedral stone, and so he couldn't tell what the team was doing inside. But if anyone tried to slip out, the thermal would pick it up. It was 60 seconds later that a thermal sensor pinged. Working on the same principle as home security systems, the detector had identified a strong temperature differential. Usually this meant a human form moving through a cool space. But what appeared on the monitor was more of a thermal cloud. A patch of hot air drifting across the lawn. The pilot found the source, an active vent on the side of Cathedral College. Probably nothing, he thought. He saw these kinds of gradients all the time. Someone cooking or doing laundry. As he was about to turn away, though, he realized something odd. There were no cars in the parking lot and no lights on anywhere in the building. He studied the UH-60's imaging system for a long moment. Then he radioed down to his team leader.
Simpkins, It's probably nothing, but...
Incandescent temperature indicator. Langdon had to admit it was clever. It's simple science, Catherine said. Different substances incandesce at different temperatures. We call them thermal markers. Science uses these markers all the time.
Langdon gazed down at the submerged pyramid and capstone. Wisps of steam were beginning to curl over the bubbling water, although he was not feeling hopeful. He glanced at his watch, and his heart rate accelerated.
11:45 p.m.
You believe something here will luminesce as it heats up?
Not luminesce, Robert. Incandesce.
There's a big difference. Incandescence is caused by heat, and it occurs at a specific temperature. For example, when steel manufacturers temper beams, they spray a grid on them with a transparent coating that incandesces at a specific target temperature, so they know when the beams are done. Think of a mood ring. Just put it on your finger and it changes color from body heat.
Catherine, this pyramid was built in the 1800s. I can understand a craftsman making hidden release hinges in a stone box, but applying some kind of transparent thermal coating?
Perfectly feasible, she said, glancing hopefully at the submerged pyramid. The early alchemists used organic phosphors all the time as thermal markers. The Chinese made colored fireworks, and even the Egyptians...
Catherine stopped mid-sentence, staring intently into the roiling water.
What?
Langdon followed her gaze into the turbulent water but saw nothing at all. Catherine leaned in, staring more intently into the water. Suddenly she turned and ran across the kitchen toward the door.
Where are you going? Langdon shouted.
She slid to a stop at the kitchen light switch, flipped it off. The lights and exhaust fan went off, plunging the room into total darkness and silence.
Langdon turned back to the pyramid and peered through the steam at the capstone beneath the water. By the time Catherine made it back to his side, his mouth had fallen open in disbelief. Exactly as Catherine had predicted, a small section of the metal capstone was starting to glow beneath the water. Letters were starting to appear, and they were getting brighter as the water heated up.
Text, Catherine whispered.
Langdon nodded, dumbstruck. The glowing words were materializing just beneath the engraved inscription on the capstone. It looked like only three words, and although Langdon could not yet read what the words said, he wondered if they would unveil everything they had been looking for tonight.
The pyramid is a real map, Galloway had told them, and it points to a real location.
As the letters shone brighter, Catherine turned off the gas, and the water slowly stopped churning. The capstone now came into focus beneath the water's calm surface. Three shining words were clearly legible.
Chapter 90. In the dim light of the Cathedral College kitchen, Langdon and Catherine stood over the pot of water and stared at the transformed capstone beneath the surface. On the side of the golden capstone, an incandescent message was glowing. Langdon read the shining text, scarcely able to believe his eyes. He knew the pyramid was rumored to reveal a specific location, but he had never imagined that the location would be quite this specific. 8 Franklin Square.
A street address, he whispered, stunned.
Catherine looked equally amazed.
I don't know what's there, do you?
Langdon shook his head. He knew Franklin Square was one of the older sections of Washington, but he wasn't familiar with the address. He looked at the tip of the capstone and read downward, taking in the entire text. The secret hides within the order, 8 Franklin Square.
Is there some kind of order on Franklin Square? Is there a building that hides the opening to a deep spiral staircase?
Whether or not there was actually something buried at that address, Langdon had no idea. The important issue at this point was that he and Catherine had deciphered the pyramid and now possessed the information required to negotiate Peter's release. And not a moment too soon. The glowing arms on Langdon's Mickey Mouse watch indicated that they had less than 10 minutes to spare.
Make the call,
Catherine said, motioning to a phone on the wall in the kitchen.
Now!
The sudden arrival of this moment startled Langdon, and he found himself hesitating.
Are we sure about this?
I most certainly am.
I'm not telling him anything until we know Peter is safe.
Of course not. You remember the number, right?
Langdon nodded and made his way over to the kitchen phone. He lifted the receiver and dialed the man's cell phone number. Catherine came over and placed her head next to his so she could listen in. As the line began to ring, Langdon prepared himself for the eerie whisper of the man who had tricked him earlier tonight. Finally, the call connected. There was no greeting, though. No voice. Only the sound of breathing at the other end. Langdon waited, and then finally spoke. I have the information you want. But if you want it, you'll have to give us Peter.
Who is this?
A woman's voice replied. Langdon jumped. Robert Langdon, he said reflexively. Who are you? For an instant, he thought he must have dialed incorrectly.
Your name is Langdon?
The woman sounded surprised.
There's someone here asking for you.
What? I'm sorry, who is this?
Officer Paige Montgomery, with Preferred Security.
Her voice seemed shaky.
Maybe you can help us with this. About an hour ago, my partner responded to a 911 call in Kalorama Heights. A possible hostage situation. I lost all contact with her, and so I called backup and came to check the residence. We found my partner dead in the backyard. The homeowner was gone, and so we broke in. A cell phone was ringing on the hall table, and I...
You're inside? Langdon demanded.
Yes, and the 911 tip was a good one, the woman stammered. Sorry if I sound rattled, but my partner's dead, and we found a man being held here against his will. He's in bad shape, and we're working on him now. He's been asking for two people, one named Langdon and one named Catherine. That's my brother,
Catherine blurted into the receiver, pressing her head closer to Langdon's.
I made the 911 call. Is he okay? Actually, ma'am, he's...
The woman's voice cracked.
He's in bad shape. He's missing his right hand. Please, Catherine urged. I want to talk to him. They're working on him at the moment. He's in and out of consciousness. If you're anywhere in the area, you should get over here. He obviously wants to see you. We're about 6 minutes away, Catherine said. Then I suggest you hurry.
There was a muffled noise in the background, and the woman then returned to the line.
Sorry, it looks like I'm needed. I'll speak to you when you arrive.
The line went dead.
Chapter 91. Inside Cathedral College, Langdon and Catherine bounded up the basement stairs and hurried down a darkened hallway looking for a front exit. No longer did they hear the sounds of helicopter blades overhead, and Langdon felt hopeful they could slip out unseen and find their way up to Kalorama Heights to see Peter.
They found him. He's alive.
30 seconds earlier, when they'd hung up with the female security guard, Catherine had hurriedly hoisted the steaming pyramid and capstone out of the water. The pyramid was still dripping when she lowered it into Langdon's leather bag. Now he could feel the heat radiating through the leather. Excitement over Peter's discovery had temporarily trumped any further reflection on the capstone's glowing message. 8 Franklin Square. But there would be time for that once they got to Peter. As they rounded the corner at the top of the stairs, Catherine stopped short and pointed into a sitting room across the hall. Through the bay window, Langdon could see a sleek black helicopter sitting silent on the lawn. A lone pilot stood beside it, facing away from them and talking on his radio. There was also a black Escalade with tinted windows parked nearby. Staying in the shadows, Langdon and Catherine moved into the sitting room and peered out the window to see if they could see the rest of the field team. Thankfully, the huge lawn outside the National Cathedral was empty.
They must be inside the cathedral, Langdon said. They're not, a deep voice said behind them.
Langdon and Catherine wheeled around to see who had spoken. In the doorway of the sitting room, 2 black-clad figures aimed laser-sighted rifles at them. Langdon could see a glowing red dot dancing on his chest.
Nice to see you again, Professor,
said a familiar, raspy voice. The agents parted, and the tiny form of Director Sato sliced effortlessly through, crossing the sitting room and stopping directly in front of Langdon.
You've made some exceedingly poor choices tonight.
The police found Peter Solomon, Langdon declared forcefully. He's in bad shape, but he'll live. It's over.
If Sato was surprised Peter had been found, she did not show it. Her eyes were unflinching as she walked to Langdon and stopped only inches away.
Professor, I can assure you, this is nowhere near over. And if the police are now involved, it has only become more serious. As I told you earlier this evening, this is an extremely delicate situation. You never should have run away with that pyramid.
Ma'am, Catherine blurted, I need to see my brother. You can have the pyramid, but you must let...
I must,
Sato demanded, spinning to Catherine.
Ms. Solomon, I assume.
She stared at Catherine with fire in her eyes, and then turned back to Langdon.
Put the leather bag on the table.
Langdon glanced down at the pair of laser sights on his chest. He set the leather bag on the coffee table.
An agent approached cautiously, unzipped the bag, and pulled the two sides apart.
A little puff of trapped steam billowed up out of the bag. He aimed his light inside, stared for a long, puzzled moment, and then nodded to Sato. Sato walked over and peered into the bag. The wet pyramid and capstone glistened in the beam of the flashlight. Sato crouched down, looking very closely at the golden capstone, which Langdon realized she had only seen in X-ray.
The inscription,
Sato demanded.
Does it mean anything to you? The secret hides within the order?
We're not sure, ma'am.
Why is the pyramid steaming hot?
We submerged it in boiling water, Catherine said without hesitation. It was part of the process of deciphering the code. We'll tell you everything, but please let us go see my brother. He's been through...
You boiled the pyramid?
Sato demanded.
Turn off the flashlight, Catherine said. Look at the capstone. You can probably still see.
The agent flicked off his light, and Sato knelt down before the capstone. Even from where Langdon was standing, he could see that the text on the capstone was still glowing slightly.
8 Franklin Square?
Sato said, sounding amazed.
Yes, ma'am. That text was written with an incandescent lacquer or something. The 33rd degree was actually...
And the address?
Sato demanded.
Is this what this guy wants?
Yes, Langdon said. He believes the pyramid is a map that will tell him the location of a great treasure, the key to unlocking the ancient mysteries. Sato looked again at the capstone. Her expression one of disbelief.
Tell me,
she said, fear creeping into her voice.
Have you contacted this man yet? Have you already given him this address?
We tried. Langdon explained what had happened when they called the man's cell phone. Sato listened, running her tongue over her yellow teeth as he spoke. Despite looking ready to erupt with anger over the situation, she turned to one of her agents and spoke in a restrained whisper.
Send him in. He's in the SUV.
The agent nodded and spoke into his transceiver.
Send who in? Langdon said.
The only person who has any hope of fixing the goddamn mess you made.
What mess? Langdon fired back. Now that Peter is safe, everything is...
For Christ's sake!
Sato exploded.
This is not about Peter. I tried to tell you that at the Capitol building, Professor, but you chose to work against me rather than with me. Now you've made an ungodly mess. When you destroyed your cell phone, which, by the way, we were tracking, you cut off your communication with this man. And this address you uncovered, whatever the hell it is, this address was our one chance to catch this lunatic. I needed you to play his game, to provide him with this address, so we would know where the hell to catch him.
Before Langdon could reply, Sato directed the remainder of her wrath at Catherine.
And you, Miss Solomon, you knew where this maniac lived? Why didn't you tell me? You sent a rent-a-cop to this man's house? Don't you see you've ruined any chance we had of catching him there? I'm glad your brother is safe. But let me tell you this. We are facing a crisis tonight, whose ramifications far outreach your family. They will be felt all around the world. The man who took your brother has enormous power, and we need to catch him immediately.
As she finished her tirade, the tall, elegant silhouette of Warren Bellamy emerged from the shadows and stepped into the sitting room. He looked rumpled, bruised, and shaken, like he'd been through hell.
Warren!
Langdon stood up. Are you okay?
No, he replied. Not really.
Did you hear? Peter is safe. Bellamy nodded, looking dazed, as if nothing mattered anymore.
Yes, I just heard your conversation. I'm glad.
Warren, what the hell is going on? Sato intervened.
You boys can catch up in a minute. Right now, Mr. Bellamy is going to reach out to this lunatic and communicate with him, just like he's been doing all night.
Langdon felt lost. Bellamy hasn't been communicating with this guy tonight. This guy doesn't even know Bellamy is involved. Sato turned to Bellamy and raised her eyebrows. Bellamy sighed.
Robert, I'm afraid I haven't been entirely honest with you this evening.
Langdon could only stare.
I thought I was doing the right thing, Bellamy said, looking frightened.
Well,
Sato said,
now you will do the right thing, and we'd all better pray to God it works.
As if to substantiate Sato's portentous tone, the mantle clock began chiming the hour. Sato took out a Ziploc bag of items and tossed it to Bellamy.
Here's your stuff. Does your cell phone take photos?
Yes, ma'am.
Good. Hold up the capstone.
The message Malak had just received was from his contact, Warren Bellamy, the mason he had sent to the Capitol building earlier tonight to assist Robert Langdon. Bellamy, like Langdon, wanted Peter Solomon back alive, and had assured Malak he would help Langdon acquire and decipher the pyramid. All night, Malak had been receiving email updates, which had been automatically forwarded to his cell phone.
This should be interesting, Malak thought, opening the message.
From Warren Bellamy. Got separated from Langdon, but finally have info you demanded. Proof attached. Call for missing piece. WB. One attachment. JPEG.
Call for missing piece?
Malak wondered, opening the attachment. The attachment was a photo. When Malak saw it, he gasped out loud, and he could feel his heart start pounding with excitement. He was looking at a close-up of a tiny golden pyramid.
The legendary capstone.
The ornate engraving on the face carried a promising message. The secret hides within the order. Beneath the inscription, Malak now saw something that stunned him. The capstone seemed to be glowing. In disbelief, he stared at the faintly radiant text and realized that the legend was literally true. The Masonic pyramid transforms itself to reveal its secret to the worthy. How this magical transformation had occurred, Malak had no idea, and he didn't care. The glowing text was clearly pointing to a specific location in D.C., exactly as prophesied.
Franklin Square.
Unfortunately, the photo of the capstone also included Warren Bellamy's index finger, which was strategically positioned on the capstone to block out a critical piece of information. The secret hides within the order. Then Bellamy's finger. And Franklin Square.
Call for missing piece.
Malak now understood Bellamy's meaning. The architect of the Capitol had been cooperative all night. But now, he had chosen to play a very dangerous game. Chapter 92. Beneath the watchful gaze of several armed CIA agents, Langdon, Catherine, and Bellamy waited with Sato in the Cathedral College sitting room. On the coffee table before them, Langdon's leather bag was still open, the golden capstone peeking out the top. The words, 8 Franklin Square, had now faded away, leaving no evidence that they had ever existed. Catherine had pleaded with Sato to let her go see her brother, but Sato had simply shaken her head, eyes fixed on Bellamy's cell phone. It sat on the coffee table and had yet to ring.
Why didn't Bellamy just tell me the truth?
Langdon wondered. Apparently the architect had been in contact with Peter's captor all night, reassuring him that Langdon was making progress deciphering the pyramid. It was a bluff, an attempt to buy time for Peter. In fact, Bellamy was doing all he could to interfere with anyone who threatened to unveil the pyramid's secret. Now, however, it seemed that Bellamy had switched sides. He and Sato were now prepared to risk the pyramid's secret in hopes of catching this man.
"Take your hands off me," shouted an elderly voice in the hall. "I'm blind, not inept. I know my way through the college."
Dean Galloway was still protesting loudly as a CIA agent manhandled him into the sitting room and forced him into one of the chairs.
"Who's here?"
Galloway demanded, his blank eyes staring dead ahead.
"It sounds like a lot of you. How many do you need to detain an old man, really now?"
"There are 7 of us," Sato declared, "including Robert Langdon, Catherine Solomon, and your Masonic brother Warren Bellamy."
Galloway slumped, all his bluster gone. "We're okay," Langdon said. "And we just heard that Peter is safe. He's in bad shape, but the police are with him."
"Thank heavens," Galloway said. "And the—"
A loud rattling caused everyone in the room to jump. It was Bellamy's cell phone vibrating against the coffee table. Everyone fell silent.
"Okay, Mr. Bellamy," Sato said.
"Don't blow it. You know the stakes."
Bellamy took a deep breath and exhaled. Then he reached down and pressed the speakerphone button to connect the call.
"Bellamy here,"
he said, speaking loudly toward the phone on the coffee table. The voice that crackled back through the speaker was familiar, an airy whisper. It sounded like he was calling from a hands-free speakerphone inside a car.
"It's past midnight, Mr. Bellamy. I was about to put Peter out of his misery."
There was an uneasy silence in the room.
"Let me talk to him."
"Impossible," the man replied. "We're driving. He's tied up in the trunk."
Langdon and Catherine exchanged looks and then began shaking their heads at everyone. "He's bluffing. He no longer has Peter." Sato motioned for Bellamy to keep pressing.
"I want proof that Peter's alive," Bellamy said. "I'm not giving you the rest of—"
"Your worshipful master needs a doctor. Don't waste time with negotiations. Tell me the street number on Franklin Square, and I'll bring Peter to you there."
"I told you, I want—"
"Now,"
the man exploded.
"Or I will pull over, and Peter Solomon dies this instant."
"You listen to me," Bellamy said forcefully. "If you want the rest of the address, you'll play by my rules. Meet me at Franklin Square. Once you deliver Peter alive, I'll tell you the number of the building."
"How do I know you won't bring the authorities?"
"Because I can't risk double-crossing you. Peter's life is not the only card you hold. I know what's really at stake tonight."
"You do realize," the man on the phone said, "that if I sense so much as a hint of anyone other than you at Franklin Square, I will keep driving, and you will never find even a trace of Peter Solomon. And of course, that will be the least of your worries."
"I'll come alone," Bellamy replied somberly. "When you turn over Peter, I'll give you everything you need."
"Center of the square," the man said. "It will take me at least 20 minutes to get there. I suggest you wait for me as long as it takes."
The line went dead. Instantly, the room sprang to life. Sato began shouting orders. Several field agents grabbed their radios and headed for the door.
"Move! Move!"
In the chaos, Langdon looked to Bellamy for some kind of explanation as to what was actually going on tonight. But the older man was already being hurried out the door.
"I need to see my brother," Catherine shouted. "You have to let us go."
Sato walked over to Catherine.
"I don't have to do anything, Miss Solomon. Is that clear?"
Catherine stood her ground and looked desperately into Sato's small eyes.
"Miss Solomon, my top priority is apprehending the man at Franklin Square, and you will sit here with one of my men until I accomplish that task. Then, and only then, will we deal with your brother.
You're missing the point, Catherine said. I know exactly where this man lives. It's literally 5 minutes up the road in Kalorama Heights, and there will be evidence there that will help you. Besides, you said you want to keep this quiet. Who knows what Peter will start telling the authorities once he's stabilized?
Sato pursed her lips, apparently registering Catherine's point. Outside, the chopper blades began winding up. Sato frowned and then turned to one of her men.
Hartman, you take the Escalade. Transport Ms. Solomon and Mr. Langdon to Kalorama Heights. Peter Solomon is not to speak to anyone. Is that understood?
Yes, ma'am, the agent said.
Call me when you get there. Tell me what you find. And don't let these two out of your sight.
Agent Hartman gave a quick nod, pulled out the Escalade keys, and headed for the door. Catherine was right behind him. Sato turned to Langdon.
I'll see you shortly, Professor. I know you think I'm the enemy, but I can assure you that's not the case. Get to Peter at once. This isn't over yet.
Off to one side of Langdon, Dean Galloway was sitting quietly at the coffee table. His hands had found the stone pyramid, which was still sitting in Langdon's open leather bag on the table in front of him. The old man was running his hands over the stone's warm surface. Langdon said, Father, are you coming to see Peter?
I'd just slow you down.
Galloway removed his hands from the bag and zipped it up around the pyramid.
I'll stay right here and pray for Peter's recovery. We can all speak later. But when you show Peter the pyramid, would you please tell him something for me?
Of course. Langdon hoisted the bag onto his shoulder.
Tell him this.
Galloway cleared his throat.
The Masonic Pyramid has always kept her secret. Sincerely.
I don't understand. The old man winked.
Just tell Peter that. He will understand.
With that, Dean Galloway bowed his head and began praying. Perplexed, Langdon left him there and hurried outside. Catherine was already in the front seat of the SUV, giving the agent directions. Langdon climbed in back and had barely closed the door before the giant vehicle was rocketing across the lawn, racing northward to Kalorama Heights. Chapter 93 Franklin Square is located in the northwest quadrant of downtown Washington, bordered by K and 13th Streets. It is home to many historic buildings, most notably the Franklin School, from which Alexander Graham Bell sent the world's first wireless message in 1880. High above the square, a fast-moving UH-60 helicopter approached from the west, having completed its journey from the National Cathedral in a matter of minutes.
Plenty of time,
Sato thought, peering down at the square below. She knew it was critical that her men got into position undetected before their target arrived.
He said he wouldn't be here for at least 20 minutes.
On Sato's command, the pilot performed a touch hover on the roof of the tallest building around, the renowned 1 Franklin Square, a towering and prestigious office building with 2 gold spires on top. The maneuver was illegal, of course, but the chopper was there only a few seconds, and its skids barely touched the gravel rooftop. Once everyone had jumped out, the pilot immediately lifted off, banking to the east, where he would climb to silent altitude and provide invisible support from above. Sato waited as her field team collected their things and prepared Bellamy for his task. The architect was still looking dazed from having seen the file on Sato's secure laptop.
As I said, an issue of national security.
Bellamy had quickly understood Sato's meaning and was now fully cooperative.
All set, ma'am, Agent Simpkins said.
On Sato's command, the agents ushered Bellamy across the rooftop and disappeared down a stairwell, heading for ground level to take up their positions. Sato walked to the edge of the building and gazed down. The rectangular wooded park below filled the entire block.
Plenty of cover.
Sato's team fully understood the importance of making an undetected intercept.
If their target sensed a presence here and decided just to slip away, the director didn't even want to think about it. The wind up here was gusty and cold. Sato wrapped her arms around herself and planted her feet firmly to avoid getting blown.